It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Great show for you today. We've got Kevin Marks here, Tim Stevens from CNET, and Sam Lesson from The Information. We'll talk about the LA Auto Show with Tim. Sam will talk about the startup culture in Silicon Valley and the Northtel patents and Rockstar. Kevin Marks explains why it's all over for the patent troll. It's next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 485, recorded November 23rd, 2014. Uber Delenda Est. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com. Get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code TWIT5 when you check out. And by Citrix GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from the convenience of your computer, smartphone, or tablet. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. For a 30-day free trial, visit gotomeeting.com today. And by stamps.com. Start using your time more effectively with stamps.com. Use stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need right from your desk. For our special offer, go to stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter TWIT. That's stamps.com and enter TWIT. And by hover.com. Hover's the best way to buy and manage domain names. It's simple, it's honest, it's easy to use. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and enter the promo code TWIT11. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news, and what a week this has been. Fortunately, we have a brilliant panel to help us out, starting all the way to my left, your right, Kevin Marks. We know Kevin well. He's a frequent contributor to all of our shows, especially This Week in Google. Great to see you, Kevin.
Nice to see you, too.
Kevin has worked at every major company in Silicon Valley, including Google, Apple, and British Telecom. So
And Salesforce.
And Salesforce. Let's not forget Salesforce.com.
That's a fairly major. Well, they're in the city rather than the valley, but yes.
Yeah, close. You know, it's the same thing. Software. Also with us, Tim Stevens, editor-in-chief, former editor-in-chief at Engadget. He's now doing car tech at CNET. And very timely to have you on. Welcome, Tim, because the LA Car Show was this week.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And I want to welcome somebody who hasn't been on our air since we've decided 2008. But he's an old friend and I think one of the great guys in the Valley, Sam Lesson. He, you may remember him from drop.io, which was just my favorite thing. It allowed you to share files online, just create these ad hoc file sharing sites. Facebook came along, bought it, put it out of business, put Sam to work. You did the timeline, right, when you were at Facebook?
Yep, I built Timeline with a great team.
And now you're did you retire from Facebook? Did you cash in the stock and say that's it, I'm done?
I'm a huge believer in Facebook. I'm very excited about the company. Love the people that work there, but I decided at the end of August it was time for me to move on. So I left, and I am now the intern at The Information, which I'm having a blast doing.
Before you say, oh, Sam, you've come down in the world, we should point out that The Information is Jessica Lesson, his wife's really great publication, kind of a new form of tech journalism aimed at people in the know. It's a subscription-only online site and newsletter. And we've had Jessica on several times, and it's really great. We think the world of both of you.
Oh, thank you. I think the world of her too.
is this something you've always wanted to do? Is be a journalist? Because I know you're writing a weekly column now.
Yeah, I'm writing a weekly column, and I wouldn't consider myself a hardcore journalist the way the rest of the team at The Information are hardcore journalists. I'm more writing a kind of an opinion column, but I'm having a lot of fun and figuring out kind of the next steps. But I think what they're doing is awesome. And so beyond being a supportive husband, I'm having a lot of fun working with the team and putting out some content and, you know, helping where I can. So
I think that's great. Yeah. I have to say, you know, speaking as somebody who never worked in the business, I know that Kevin has, of course, and you have, both kind of entrepreneurial software guys and so forth. The nice thing about covering it is you don't have to pick sides. You don't have to, you know, you can cover the, you see everything. You have ringside seats at all the stuff that's happening. And it's so much fun.
Yeah, it's a blast. I mean, I think I love it. I'm loving kind of the perspective. I think also, honestly, you know, having spent 4 years at Facebook and, you know, being a VP of product there, and that it's a, just a different perspective that really, really changes how you approach a lot of these things, just because you have so much more context for what a lot of these big companies are going through and how they evaluate decisions. Right. So, I don't know. Life is good.
I think it's great to get an entrepreneur on that, on this side, because, yeah, you know more than, you know, more than a lot on exactly what's going on inside. And so I'm glad you're here, because, of course, our top story, unfortunately, has to be Uber. And but I think it's a – I don't want to cover the – we will cover a little bit the kind of what happened, he said, she said thing. But more importantly, I think maybe a culture clash between the go-go startup culture of Silicon Valley and the rest of the world. And you've been in the middle of it. What's your take? And I know you've written about this at The Information. What's your take on what's going on at Uber?
I mean, I have all the respect in the world for Uber. I think it's one of the most exciting companies probably ever in terms of both what it represents for the future. But I also think they sit at this very interesting spot and kind of are the poster child for this new generation of Silicon Valley companies that actually have a meaningful and immediate impact in the real world. You know, I think the last generation of companies – I'm writing a call about this tomorrow, but like the last generation of companies – existed in this world where they're working on productivity or communication or things where you can have great impact, but you're not changing the day-to-day in an immediate way the way a company like Uber is. And I think that, you know, when you look at Uber or Airbnb, a lot of the things that are going on now, there's such a dramatic impact in the real world immediately that it really raises the bar of attention that's put on them and kind of the professionalism that needs to happen in a lot of areas. So, you know, my kind of take is they're a company that's figuring it out. They're fundamentally good people from my perspective and the ones I know that are there. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot to figure out and you have to grow up quickly in this day and age in terms of just the amount of attention that's put on these things.
Jessica Lessen's lead story at The Information is that in Uber saga, there are no calls for adult supervision. I don't know. I'll call for adult supervision. It seems like something odd is going on. There is this he said, she said back and forth, and I'm not sure exactly what actually happened. We can't know because it was at a private dinner. Uber has been accused in the past of being kind of high-handed with privacy. There's the God mode on Uber that tells Uber employees exactly where every car is and who's riding in those cars, and that information could theoretically be gathered to pinpoint locations of people. A couple of journalists have accused Uber of misusing that. One pointed out that he got a text from somebody who was at an Uber party, said, "You're on the big map right now. We know exactly where you are." Uber unwisely decided to put the God mode up on a big screen at a party. Another said that Uber, in an effort to put pressure on this journalist, an Uber executive was waiting for him when he arrived, or her, in the car, and said, "Well, I know exactly where you are at all times because you're riding in an Uber." That scares people. There have been several cases of there's a case of assault by an Uber driver. There's an Uber driver in San Francisco is accused of having killed a 6-year-old running over a family. But the ironically, after all of that, the big story really is this Uber executive, Emil Michael, who at a private dinner, speaking to the editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed, according to the editor-in-chief at BuzzFeed, said that Uber should do opposition research on journalists who are critical of Uber and attempt to dig up dirt on them. In particular, Sarah Lacey from Pando Daily, and apparently, according to Ben Smith, the editor at BuzzFeed, he said that Emil told him that there's some particular information that would be very damaging to her. Lacey immediately took umbrage and has made the rounds. Some have accused her of capitalizing on this. Another journalist who was sitting next to the two at the same event said nothing like that actually happened.
Didn't. She basically confirmed the narrative, but said he didn't mean it.
Well, she didn't say he threatened. Okay, let's find this article then, because it's complicated.
And at this point, I'm not sure who to believe. Ben Smith of BuzzFeed may be exaggerating this. He did one thing that was a little suspect. His initial story referred to a BuzzFeed journalist that was there, not saying it was himself, which was odd.
Look, I think there's a big question of just in this day and age, especially the relationship between a lot of these publications that, you know, and again, I have all the respect and love in the world for BuzzFeed, but, you know, they exist in this zone of publications that need to attract a lot of attention because they're paid for attention. And so, you know, I think there is a lot of mistrust right now from all angles. I think the he said, she said, who knows? Like, the reality is you can't trust anyone on this stuff.
Well, that's, I'll be honest, I trusted Ben Smith until I read Nicole Campbell's post on the Huffington Post. She worked at the Obama White House with Emil Michael, was at this dinner.
No, Michael hasn't disputed that he said it, and she doesn't dispute that he said it. They're just saying, but I was joking, I was drunk. There is, you know, no one has actually disputed.
Nicole said there was no anti-feminist sentiment, no attacking families, no attacking children, no anger, no threats against anyone, no action plan, nothing. It was clear to me this was all a vague, civilized conversation. I'm a woman, I'm sensitive to any talk of this kind. Now she says, I admit I'm a friend of Emil's, but she said, I believe Ben's comments, the BuzzFeed editor's comments, caused Sarah some understandable angst. Sarah, take it from me, what Ben reported is not true. This is the article.
Look, I think what's clear out of this episode is that when
companies, why did Ben admit it on the day and apologize to them all?
Emil,
this is like subsequent spin. No, Emil admitted.
It's very confusing. Yeah, Uber has said Emil didn't say this.
Right, exactly. He said it. He's apologized. Travis has sort of semi-apologized. He did apologize to Sarah, but he's
missing a little bit though. I mean, it's all just hearsay. We don't really, I mean, what's missing is context. We don't know what the context was, what the spirit of it was.
But the tone of it, you know, the tone of it is the problem. And I think that this sense of, you know, this God mode sense is part of the problem. And I recognize part of where that comes from, because it comes from when you start a startup, there's a very small number of you and you're working against these enormous forces in the rest of the world and it feels like you're going to take everyone on. And then as it grows, that pressure only grows on you, and then eventually, you know, you have a large company if you're really lucky and things go well, and you don't always realize that things have changed. And you're now a big company. We've seen that happen with Microsoft. We've seen it happen with Google. We've seen it happen with Facebook, where the founders have started out with this sort of massive self-belief and us against the world model, and then eventually realize, wait a minute, we are actually big enough that this is a factor where we impact the world, and it's how they behave after that makes the difference.
Well, I agree, and I think that's a good point, which is just like these companies grow up so fast at this point. I mean, you know, unwind Uber 2 years, and let's talk about kind of the way you'd operate a company at that scale versus a company at the scale they're at now. Right now, they're moving so quickly. That's not to apologize for it. I mean, I think there's things that they obviously should be doing better at and need to get on top of. But the reality is, these questions of tone, these questions of what was meant. It doesn't matter. The reality is they're a big company with a big footprint. People watch what they do, and they have to level up very quickly, much more quickly than almost any other company in history in terms of how they approach these situations because of the scale of their operations and the responsibility they have. So they're going to figure it out. I mean, I think they're going to figure it out. This is an unfortunate situation. It was an unfortunate episode. And the reality is it doesn't really matter what was said. What matters is what comes out of it on the other side.
Well, it also matters how they behave, and that's why the God mode stuff is actually scarier. The reason I deleted Uber this week was I was like, okay, I don't actually feel confident that you are good custodians of this data at the moment. Maybe after you've got some processes in place that make me feel more comfortable, I'll come back. You know, and we had this with Facebook and the ability for everyone to see everyone else's profile that Kate Lossie described in her book. And I don't want to put you on the spot about that, Sam, but you know, I know how this stuff works as well. When you've built the thing for the first time, everyone can see the database because you've only got one database. Anyone who's in engineering can write queries against it, and you end up writing little tools to understand what's going on. And it's only later you realize, actually, this can be used for negative things, and letting people have access to data like this is a policy problem and something we have to build structures around. And I think
I don't think anyone would contest that, including Uber, frankly. I don't speak for them, obviously, but I think that's absolutely it's true. It's you have to build these tools. When you start going from having 20 employees to 1,000, the internal controls you have to put in place are real and need to happen. So that's pretty clear.
Yeah. I just have to wonder, where is Uber's PR in all of this? Why are they allowing for vice presidents to sit at dinners with journalists and say things like this without someone stepping in and saying, hey, by the way, just to remind everybody, this is off the record?
Well, it wasn't off the record. Apparently wasn't off the record dinner. Smith was invited by Michael Wolff, who knew it was off the record. But Michael said, I just assumed Ben would know it was off the record. It wasn't. I mean, he didn't treat it that way.
Really, to be there at that time to say, just to make sure that everybody knows. And you know, I've been at these sorts of dinners, and it's always repeated. This is off the record, especially when something as sensitive as this would come up. So I'm wondering if that's again part of the learning, part of the maturation that's required here for Uber, is to know exactly when they need help. And I think they need help in this regard. And you know, I'm sure that they have people who are helping them. But maybe they need more help. Maybe they need a little bit more sophistication, and maybe they need to dial down things a little bit until they can get everything in check, until they get a little bit more media training, perhaps, too, until they can get a little bit more comfortable knowing what they can and cannot say, even in what seems like a casual environment.
I hate to let them off the hook, but then at the same time, I'm not sure I trust Ben Smith. The whole thing is a mess. And by the way, John Hodgman tweeted he's not going to use Uber anymore. Gina Trapani and Jeff Jarvis on This Week in Google said they're not going to use Uber anymore. I certainly wouldn't if I had, but my only experience using Uber was in Paris. I got ripped off by the driver, and I haven't used it since then.
I think you should check in with those people in a year.
Yeah. Well, I think it's hard not to use Uber because the truth about it is, all this aside, the experience is generally very good. You rate the driver rates you. I don't know what it's like to drive for Uber. I'm hearing ads on the radio every day saying we'll give you $5,000 in your first month to become an Uber driver. And yet I also hear drivers saying it's terrible experience being a driver. I want out. I don't know what to think. There's so many conflicting stories. And this is an interesting, I think the larger story to me, which I think is more interesting from my point of view, is that this is going to be the way things are going forward, is that there will be many, because of the internet, because of social media, because of the speed of the news cycle, because there is no longer a single source of truth in it. You know, there used to be the Journal of Record, the New York Times or CBS. There's no longer a single source of truth. So I think more and more stories are going to be like this. We're going to hear different things from a lot of different people. Everybody has suspect motivations. Ben Smith wants to get clicks, the whole thing, it starts to become very difficult for an end user, an end consumer of news, to know what's true and what to do.
This has always been true. You know, the assumption that news used to be objective is a myth. And I know Jeff Jarvis would take you to task on that as well. The thing is, there was always the agendas being pushed. It was just the question of how many people were able to speak about them
I think something is fundamentally different now. And again, this is a little self-serving on behalf of my wife. But like, you know, what's different now is the business model and how people get paid. When you get paid for clicks, when you get paid for getting people attention through social media and your site, that incentivizes a certain type of discussion and reporting and sensationalism that I think isn't true if you're running a subscription service or you're actually paid to be a trusted source of knowledge. So yeah, I think it's always a spectrum. Things aren't black and white in the world, but I think it's a little bit simplistic to say nothing has changed. I mean, the business models that people are running and therefore what types of information moves around is dramatically different than it was, you know, 20 years ago.
Well, yes, now I don't want to say that the only model is the information's model. Certainly there's a benefit to that because the information only has to respond to its subscribers. They don't have to generate clicks. They don't have advertisers. But I would hope, given that we're ad-supported free media, that there's a role for ad-supported free media, which is a kind of a more traditional way of doing things. And I would hope that BuzzFeed, I'll put Vice in this category, are different ways of doing journalism, but they've done some good journalism. I just think it's very hard for the consumer to know who to trust.
It's very hard as a journalist to maintain that independence from you know, an intent of trying to get more traffic. You know, back in the day, if you're writing for a big newspaper or a big outlet, you didn't really worry about how many people were reading your story. You wanted to get on the front page for sure, but it didn't matter to you if your story helped to sell more newspapers, because ultimately your job was secure regardless. Now, you know, a lot of these outlets, a lot of these operations are much smaller, and you really feel the pressure to be able to drive those clicks, to drive that traffic, to help the money coming in. You know, there's always supposed to be a separation between church and state, we say, you know, where you don't know what the advertising is, you don't know the advertising dollars, and you don't worry about that sort of thing. But ultimately, if you're at a smaller outlet or you know, some kind of a startup journalistic publication, you have a pretty good feel for what is doing well and what is not doing well. And, you know, if these stories aren't doing well, then you know that the writing's on the wall, things aren't going to last too long. So there's that pressure for sure, and I can.
You were in the hot seat. You were editor chief at Engadget at right, AOL. Absolutely. I can't imagine more of a hot seat.
Yeah, and there was certainly a lot of pressure at AOL to do a lot of things that I didn't want to do with Engadget, which may be why things are the way they are right now. But that's okay. So you know, there's a lot of pressure for sure, whether you are a journalist or whether you are the editor in chief of a site like that, or whether you're indeed someone who's running on the business side of things and responsible for ad revenue and everything else. There's a lot of pressure to get the traffic up there and to make these things work. And ultimately, I think that pressure is now more closely felt by journalists than probably ever in the past.
It worries me because I think as a consumer, there's an undue burden on me to determine the truth. There is innuendo flying right and left. And it's kind of the natural thing, I'm speaking for myself, to say, well, where there's smoke, there must be fire. So something happened here. But maybe it's not the right response to say, well, I'm giving up on Uber, because maybe we don't really know. I don't know.
I think it's a question of who do you trust?
Well, Sam, why am I in a year going to use Uber again? Or they?
Because it's a great service, and because honestly, you don't know what went on, and hopefully they're going to mature. I'm sure they will. They'll get more controls in place. You know, these things, they're moving fast. And again, that's not to apologize. I think clearly mistakes were made in the fact that there was a huge cycle around this.
Maybe that what they'll get under control is the news cycle, not their own internal policies. Maybe God mode won't go away. They'll just learn how to hide it better. That's
the thing. They have been deleting the blog posts off their site where they were doing the data analysis, which is sketchy behavior.
And then
those posts did evoke an attitude, and they were 2 years old. Okay, so but you don't just say, oh, let's just delete this from the site and pretend it didn't happen. You know, had discussed what you changed rather than
What would you tell young people growing up today who are growing up in this world about, critical thinking? What do you teach them? How do you teach them what to believe and what not to believe? Is there a rule? You've got young adult children. What do you tell them?
Well, the part of it is that they're immersed in it and they can work it out for themselves. Yes, if you actually read young adult novels these days, half of them is about media narrative and understanding. Yeah. If you read The Hunger Games, half of it is like fighting, and the other half is how is this presented in the media?
That's true.
If you read Harry Potter, there's the entire Rita Skeeter thread. If you read the Uglies trilogy, a big chunk of that is how they're perceived, discovering what's wrong with society, and then how they're perceived once they do it. So there is this sense of necessary, and Cory Doctorow has written like three young adult novels that have massive components of media explanations and government cover-up and what it means to be growing up in this world. So I think that the literature is already there for them, but also it's pervasive in their world. When I got my sons to sign up for Known, which is a blogging website that lets you connect to different social networks, I was surprised how reluctant they were to connect it to Facebook, because from their point of view, they'd been burnt before by connecting things to Facebook, and they didn't know what it would send out there. And Facebook for them is not their communication mechanism so much as the public space, the notice board where other people can see things. And they were very aware, and they're very aware of managing what they post on Facebook as opposed to what they send in more covert channels.
What would you tell your kids, Tim Stevens?
Well, my kids are both four-legged, and
they don't read.
So they don't worry about journalism too much. I do, though.
You've seen the sausage being made. You've been right in there.
And the question that I've had all week was just how much is this story resonating with those of us outside of the journalism and startup community?
That's a good point.
Because obviously it's been a huge story amongst us and you know, the close circles around us. But I still haven't gotten a good feel for how many people were aware of it. In fact, I was in L.A. this week, and I did use an Uber. I did feel guilty about it, but I did use an Uber. I talked to the driver a bit and just kind of asked him how business was, and he indicated that things were a little bit slower than usual. But he didn't know anything about any of this controversy at all. And here's a guy who's, you know, livelihood is dependent on Uber, and he wasn't aware of this story at all, which made me wonder just how many people outside of this, you know, inner journalistic and startup circle actually are aware of any of this at all. And realistically, how much does it impact those people? That's probably the biggest question I've had. You know, this is it's almost insider baseball, this sort of thing. It's a big indicator of the culture of the company for sure. But do people outside of the circle really, really care about that?
Well,
let me give Sam a chance. And
come on, Sam. Okay.
Look,
Sam, you didn't. I apologize. Here you are. You're an intern at the information, brand new to this business.
No, I mean, here's the way I would look at it is, I mean, again, I have a bias here. I have an opinion about kind of, you know, how I think about, you know, media consumption like that. I think the thing that has really changed is who do media organizations work for in the end of the day, and whose side are they on, and who can you trust? And to me, I think I strongly believe, and it's obviously self-serving, that the future of the world is going to look a lot more like the past, and that you will be paying agents to do serious reporting for you, and you'll just pay them, like you'll trust them because their entire incentive will be aligned with providing great information.
You mean I'm going to have to hire a private investigator to figure out whether I should have an Uber account?
No, you're going to pool. You and a lot of other people will hire them together. And that doesn't mean there isn't places for all sorts of different types of media and discussion. But in the end of the day, just you are how you make money. That's kind of what ends up happening, right?
You intimately connected with the Silicon Valley startup scene. Is the kind of the bro attitude that we're kind of seeing, I think we're seeing here at Uber, this is fairly widespread, especially in early stage startups, right?
What's the bro attitude?
Well, this kind of, we're going to take on the world. It's us against the world. I mean,
I think starting companies is kind of a crazy exercise, right? Like, I think you have to have that delusion and that drive to ever even rationally go off and try to start anything. So I think it's actually an important part of like early startup culture. I think the question is, how do the things that do really work mature? How do the controls come into place? What's the timing on that? And when do you wake up and realize, oh my God, we're winning, and we're having a real impact, and there's responsibility that comes with that you have to grow into rapidly. And again, I think it's been said by others, but you know, this is not a new pattern. It's just honestly, I think this is probably one of the fastest, you know, growths, at least in valuation, that I think has ever happened in the world.
They're 3 years old.
Up to that.
How old is Uber? 3 or 4 years?
I think it's more than three.
In 2008 it was started. So yeah, they're more than that. They're 6 years old. They currently have the most venture funding of any startup out of Silicon Valley, probably of any startup in the world. They're valued at what? A couple of billion more than that? I can't remember. But
it depends on who you ask, but between 15 and 20.
15 and 20 billion. I mean, the growth has been insane in the last 2 years.
And it's a great service.
And people love it. Although I think there are some concerns, legitimate concerns. I mean, this Uber X driver who almost killed the guy with a hammer last week. I mean... It seems to happen more in San Francisco, I guess, because there's more rides in San Francisco.
Look, and I guess I'm playing my part as the guy sitting in Silicon Valley.
You're the startup guy. You represent the startup guy.
So I'm playing my role perfectly, I feel like, on the show. But, like, look, you know, the reality is there's a lot they're going to have to figure out and a lot of responsibility that comes with being as successful as they have been and will be going forward. So I think there's a lot to learn there. But I have less sympathy for people sensationalizing the driver incident. I mean, if you drive enough miles,
right,
you're going to have an incident. I mean,
that's what Uber says.
Every cab in every country. And said, is there ever an incident? And of course there is. Like, there's no way not to have that happen.
Surge pricing bothers people. You know, they don't know how much it's going to cost. It's raining, and all of a sudden it's triple the cost.
And look, if that ends up being an issue, then a company like Flywheel, which I take frequently and doesn't have surge pricing, or Lyft, will win. I mean,
there is competition.
There's competition. Mm. It's not like it's, you know, there's a one-stop shop here. But again, like, I think these things are going to shake out, and it's an unfortunate episode. I think it says more about kind of the media culture and than anything else. But it also like is a wake up call to, I think, a lot of executives of these companies that like, look, you're not some baby in the corner anymore. People are paying attention. They care. And you got to be really careful about the message and image you're putting out because it matters.
It's also the case that as consumers of news, we now have to look behind every place you go. You have to, well, are they an investor? For instance, Peter Thiel, the well-known Silicon Valley investor, said Uber's the most ethically challenged company in Silicon Valley. And then you learn Peter Thiel is an investor in Lyft. So it's all, then now everything he says has to be suspect. And it seems like everybody's got some allegiance to one side or the other. And
he may have meant that as a compliment, you know.
From Peter Thiel, that might be like a good thing. I don't know. But I do have to point out that Sergey and Larry brought in Eric Schmidt. Mark Zuckerberg brought in Sheryl Sandberg. That it is not unusual for companies, as you, I think you said it, Kevin, they have to have this go-go attitude, us against the world when they're first starting up. But eventually, they do bring in adult supervision.
But that's the problem. But the adult supervision they've brought in is Emil Michael. You know, that's the
he's the adult.
He's the one. He's the political operative dude. They've hired. He was at
the White House.
He was at the White House. He was at Cloud, which is okay, not another company.
Cloud. Okay, come on.
Yeah,
that is not not a good pedigree at all.
Right, but that's the thing. He's one of the execs they've hired in to be this sort of adult supervision. That's the thing that's nervous making about it.
Yeah. It feels at this point now like it's a gossip story, not a tech story.
Which is what Uber has worked very hard to make it. You know, Uber has spent this week with some very expensive crisis PR people trying to shift the narrative.
Interesting.
You know, if you think about the stories that have come out and that Huffington Post piece and things like that, that's a sign that they've
product,
been working.
That's placement.
Yeah, that's clear placement.
Hey, Nicole, and, you want to write a little story about your friend Emil? Yeah.
And that's, you know, obviously they get to tell their side of it. That's fair enough. But they haven't done anything, you know, formally and above board apart from 13 tweets.
That's right. And they certainly haven't censured, as far as we know, or certainly not fired Emil Michael. I wonder.
Well, they've emailed everyone who says, I want to leave Uber, saying he doesn't speak for us, which is kind of weird.
He's our senior vice president for business, but he doesn't speak for us. He's out there. I just feel like, it's hard for us as consumers to really know what to do. And I think the larger issue is Uber protecting our privacy. If you're a tech journalist, you might not want to ride in an Uber just because, what are they up to?
I don't think that's just an Uber thing, though. I mean, when I reviewed the Tesla Model S a few years back, I picked up the car. I was driving back home, and I got a check engine light or some kind of a warning light on the dashboard. I called up the PR rep at Tesla, and she said, hang on, I'll connect you over to an engineer. And about 30 seconds later, she said, oh, yeah, we're watching it. Don't worry. It's just a tire pressure thing. You're fine.
We're watching it. We saw the light. In our control center.
New York Times thing. So, you know, I always have a pretty good idea that if I'm reviewing a smartphone or if I'm reviewing a car, that company is watching everything that I do at all times. And that's the big thing that I don't know about this whole God mode thing is, okay, this guy was out front waiting for the journalist to show up. Was that journalist using a coupon code from Uber for a free ride, or were they using their personal account? You know, there's some details that I don't know there, but I always assume as a journalist that I'm being watched pretty much everything that I do, even Gmail, things like that.
I think we can all assume as citizens of the United States we're being watched everything we do, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit.
I was going to say, it is interesting, though. Like, showing up at someone's house, I hadn't heard this story before, but that's just honestly, and again, with respect to whoever's involved, like, that's just like poor form. It's like, even if you could do that, that's like clearly a terrible idea, right? And I think that's like part of like becoming more mature as a company is just being like, oh, like that seemed like a fine idea when we were a tiny company, and now that we're not, that's just like a bad idea.
Yeah, but that's just cosmetics to say, oh, well, don't do that, because that's cosmetics. Oh, that looks bad. Don't do that. You could still have the same, you know, you can have the idea in your head. But just don't tell anybody. Well,
I think there's a risk reward to it. In the end of the day, if I'm an Uber and I'm like, look, the cost, we're winning. Like, the cost of getting this wrong the cost is blown up, I think, is actually quite large. Like, I don't think this is something that's just a tech press issue and gets blown over. I think this is a big deal. Like, this is so expensive for them that they're not going to be that dumb going forward.
You know, Airbnb had its big meeting, global meeting here in San Francisco. Liz Gaines was there, talked and kind of compared Airbnb and how everybody who has an Airbnb service loves their CEO, and contrasted the two. And then at the same time, Airbnb has announced a device that, as an Airbnb host, you can put in your house that listens anytime you want to see if they're having a party in your house or if they're smoking. And it's like, oh, well, I'm not going to use Airbnb anymore. They have a listening device in the house. So the landlord could say, and I, all right, what a world. Let's take a break. I want to talk about shaving. How about that? We have a great sponsor, and I don't think there's any conflict of interest here if I say that I shave every day with Harry. I have Harry in the shower. I have Harry in the bath. Sometimes I'll even use Harry here at the studio. You've caught me a few times shaving. This is Movember. A lot of you are growing facial hair and to raise awareness around men's health issues. That's fine. I just want you to know that Harry supports Movember. Absolutely. And they're even going to give money to the Movember fund to show their support. But when it's over, come December, and Jessica's saying it's time to shave that ugly-ass beard, think Harry's. Harry's is the best kind of shaving experience you'll ever have. Harry's makes their own razors. They bought the factory. This is a startup that I like. When Jeff, who was a serial entrepreneur, he did Warby Parker. When he started looking into, you know, I think we could do razors better. He's interested in kind of reinventing these old school businesses. Well, it's a classic, you know, story. We give away the razors and we make it up on the blades. These blades, you go and you try to buy a Gillette blade, it's like, what? It's $4 a blade. They're so expensive, they lock them up at the drugstore. That's ridiculous. So when Harry started, they said, we want to give you quality razors, better than the razors you get at the drugstore, at half the price. So what did they do? They bought the factory. There it is in Germany. They found out there were two factories in the world that made the best blades in Solingen, Germany. They bought one. And they engineer their blades for not just for sharpness, but for high performance. They ship them for free to your door. And because they make and ship their own blades, they're more efficient. That means you're getting factory direct pricing. Get a Harry's kit to start yourself off. The kits are an amazing deal. You get the razor with a handle that looks and feels great, three razor blades, the foaming shave gel, it smells so good. The Truman set, $15. I got a Winston. That's the metal handle engraved, just a little bit more. You get all that for $15, and then you get your blades delivered to you. I was getting them every other month. I'm getting them monthly now, because I shave more, because it's easy. It doesn't cut me up, doesn't abrade. It's great. I want you to try Harry's. This would be a great gift. Ladies, if you want to convince your Movember man to drop the beard and mustache come December, harrys.com. Do use the offer code TWIT5, and you'll get $5 off your first purchase with Harry's, and you'll be supporting Movember. They'll give a little donation in your name, and then get those blades delivered monthly or every other month. It's awesome. HARRYS, harrys.com for this Movember. You're watching This Week in Tech. Kevin Marks is here, old friend of the show. We've got him on regularly on Twig. Also, Sam Lesson from The Information and from CNET, the wonderful Tim Stevens. So you wanted to come on, Kevin. You tweeted me to talk, because last week I thought we had a very important show. We talked about net neutrality, about President Obama's request that the FCC use Title II of the Telecommunications Act to regulate ISPs, broadband providers, as common carriers. We had a couple of – I thought the best way to handle this was to have ISPs on. One on each side. We had Dane Jasper of SonicNet, who thinks that's a good idea, oddly enough. And then we had Brett Glass, who is a wireless internet service provider in Laramie, Wyoming. He thinks he doesn't want that extra government regulation. And I thought we had a very good conversation. I thought both were very well spoken. Frankly, it didn't help me because I agreed with both of them. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think, I mean, what you find is that the ISPs that have a local monopoly aren't in favor, and the ones who are in a competitive market are in favor. And I think that played out with your show as well.
Yes, Brett, because Brett was in a very difficult market.
Brett, you know, Brett is doing something that's very difficult, which is trying to do it, be an ISP over wireless in a very sparsely populated area. And so a lot of the issues around competition that arise in urban areas don't really apply. But the challenge for me is there is a sense that this is a natural monopoly, and that's how it's historically been regulated. And so therefore, the local authority gives permission to certain companies to lay cables in that neighborhood in return for something. It may be a network for them, it may be taxes, it may be something like that. But then they don't license anyone else, or they only license very few companies to do that. So I'm in San Jose, the self-named capital of Silicon Valley, and my choice is Comcast or AT&T.
Oh, isn't that nice? Aren't you lucky?
It's giving me lovely twisted pair internet said, oh, we laid a fiber sort of three streets away and we'll run some twisted pairs over to you. It's like, there is a physical infrastructure challenge. And so the way that's been handled in other places is a bit what we call structural separation, where, and this goes back to my BT experience, this happened in the UK. BT was originally the post office, the UK post office, and then it was British Telecom. And it took over the telephone network. And then it basically had all the cables that had been laid. It had the terrestrial monopoly of existing cables. And so to create a level playing field there, what the government said was, okay, you need to separate out the piece that piece of the company that owns the physical infrastructure and sell connectivity to that to your network company that's selling to customers on the same terms as you do to everyone else. And that's regulated by government. So there's an explicit separation between the physical layer and the services layer. And that was the case in the US for a while. And that was the piece that was overturned by the change in regulations when they moved from Title II to Title I.
So, wait a minute. We never had the situation where the government owned the infrastructure in the US.
But you had the situation where they were required to...
Open their plants, yeah.
Yes.
Right now, telecoms are required to open their doors to other ISPs, but cable is not.
Right, but also they've actually sort of effectively evaded it.
Yeah, I mean, when Dane, who was here, is a DSL provider, and of course he rides on copper provided by all the incumbent carriers like AT&T and Verizon, and he's told me off the record some horrible tales of anti-competitive action by the big phone companies. They don't want third-party internet service providers.
Right, so they try to do it in a regulatory way rather than in a structural way. So the thing that I wanted to bring up was the idea of structural separation,
It's never going to happen in the U.S. It's political dynamite. We can't even agree on...
I'm saying that's another option. I mean, the other thing would be...
I agree. I mean, I think government should take over all the infrastructure using eminent domain, but that's not going to happen.
No, I'm not saying that. The other thing is what people have called ducks neutrality, which is letting people...
That sounds like a tax dodge.
To lay other cables over the top of the existing network. The cost of laying a cable from here to the central operating thing from my house will be approximately what it costs to replace the fence at my house. The physical cost of that is not that high, and I replace the fence every few years or so.
Yeah, but you don't want five companies trenching out at your backyard.
Sure, but the point is I could pick one and decide if we terminate it at the other end.
Right. Yeah. I think there are solutions, but I don't think that. I think there's also the political issue, and I think we're in a climate where it's going to be very difficult to solve this because, well, hell, we can't. I mean, for crying out loud, we couldn't even get a majority to vote against NSA collection of phone records this week.
That's true, and
that's pathetic.
And the other thing is, it's often a local political issue,
right?
So.
I've done my best. I served on the technology committee here in Petaluma and strongly urged that because Comcast was not living up to its agreement. Comcast has, as all cable companies do, a regional monopoly, a franchise awarded it to it by the local municipality. And Comcast had promised all sorts of things, delivered none of it. But the city government was very reluctant, and I don't blame them, to pull the plug on Comcast, because the last thing they want is every voter in the town of Petaluma pissed off at them because their cable doesn't work. You don't want to mess with it. We have this house of cards. It's kind of working. And that, this is one of the things that the folks who advocate no government interference always say. Where's the problem? There hasn't been a problem. You're regulating to protect against something that hasn't happened yet and probably won't happen. I don't know if there's a good answer.
The interesting thing is the stuff that Google Fiber is doing, where they are actually starting saying, okay, we want to find some helpful municipalities and we'll work with them first, and we'll iterate through that. And,
that's a good idea.
And then put pressure on the others. Get pressure from people like me in San Jose. Say, hey, San Jose, can you sign up for Google to do this? Because it sounds like Kansas City got a really good deal compared to what we have.
Right.
So that I think that is a good strategy, but it's a 10-15 year strategy. And I suspect other tech firms may find that they want to do that too.
And what you see also is companies like AT&T saying, oh, yeah, we offer gigabit. At the minute Google comes to town, oh, yeah, we offer gigabit. And then it's not really gigabit.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I think there's a question also whether you really want Google controlling the end-to-end stack as well. I mean...
That's a good point too.
It's you know, I have a very hard time with this issue. I usually am pretty opinionated, and I can see either side in the net neutrality debate in pretty clear contrast. I don't know if you guys have read this book called The Master Switch.
Tim Wu. It's a great book, and I've been trying to get Tim Wu on, but he won't talk in public anymore.
I love that book. I think it's like the best articulation, if you look at the whole history of media, of how these issues play out. Having finished it, I don't think it actually like helped me make a decision about where I stand on it, but it was it's definitely worth reading.
The more you know about this, the harder it is to come up with a good answer that's not either having government take it all over or, I mean, competition would solve this. That's pretty obvious, but how are we going to foster competition? Somebody needs to invent a great wireless service that is easy and cheap. Maybe Project Loon. You know, Google announced that they can now do 20 balloon launches a day. They've got Project Loon is the crazy idea of putting balloons, basically weather balloons, up in the stratosphere, twice as high as airplanes, higher even than weather. And the nice thing about the stratosphere is there are winds in a variety of directions at different layers. So you can just control the balloon's movement by moving it up or down into the layer you want. So it'll go in the direction you want. And they launched these in New Zealand, the idea being to provide internet access via balloon. Something like that would really change things.
It wouldn't, though. I mean, you still have to deliver the signal down, and someone still regulates and owns the airwaves and the radio frequencies.
Doesn't Facebook want to do drones, do the same thing?
I think these are all fascinating long-term technologies, but they don't get around the fact that you have sovereign governments that, you know, have rights over their airspace and their wire lines and all sorts of things that you have to interface with.
It's impossible, isn't it? What is Facebook's? It was the Internet Foundation. Is that it?
Internet.org.
Yeah.
Facebook Zero is the Facebook network thing, right? Where they work with carriers in Africa to make Facebook free.
Internet.org. The idea.
There's a lot of efforts that are going on at Facebook right now to help kind of connect the next billion people, which are all really exciting.
Yeah.
Okay, but Sam, now, I'm going to give you a chance because, of course, me, the first thing I think is, well, of course, Facebook wants everybody online using Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the thing to go back to is, again,
and so does Google.
There's no question that's true, but I think if you step back for a second, you know, I think people sometimes have a hard time believing this, but I at least fervently do and represent that, like, the Facebook is a company who is mission first in the end of the day. You know, Mark, I think when the company went public had a great line about how, you know, Facebook is organized as a company to fulfill its mission, not the other way around. And the fundamental mission is to connect the entire world. So, you know, can you talk about long-term business? What does it mean for the long-term business to help connect, bring another billion people online? Of course, like that's like obvious. But I think that the bigger thing is that this is like from a mission standpoint first, not a company standpoint, fundamental to like what Facebook is meant to represent and do. So it's pretty cool, I think, a lot of the efforts that are going on in there. But they're all, you know, again, very early in terms of how they're playing out.
I like this. I thought this was interesting. Speaking of this notion of a paywall and journalism that's paid for by its consumers, Google is experimenting with this Google Contributor service, which I think is a great idea, and I'm curious what you guys think about it. The idea is you, I guess, that you pay a certain fee And Google feeds that money out between $1 to $3 a month to sites like Mashable, The Onion, and by doing so, eliminates the Google ads on those sites.
I think the best application of that would be YouTube, and I'm surprised we haven't seen something like that already because people hate pre-roll on YouTube with a passion. And I think that's a great opportunity for them to roll something like this out if you pay, you know, $10 a month, $5 a month, and no more pre-roll ads on YouTube. I think a lot of people would pay for that, especially if they knew that that money was going back to where it belongs, which is to the content creators.
Susan Wojcicki has raised that as a possibility, I think.
I think it's a very unlikely possibility.
Why is that?
Well, the problem with these plans, honestly, like YouTube, which is obviously a really important service for Google in terms of where they're going, is you get all the people who are most valuable opt out of your ads, right? Like, in the end of the day, it's exactly the demographics that are willing to pay money for these things that people...
That's who advertisers
want to reach,
yeah.
Right? What you're doing is you're creating this, like, reverse incentive, right, where basically you're removing the most valuable segment of the advertising population you're moving towards. So I would go on record saying that I would be shocked if they did this on something like YouTube, whereas I think in the content network, on, you know, sites, et cetera, it's a service that people have talked about for a long time. There's no reason not to offer it and see what happens. I personally am skeptical that it'll work, but we'll see.
It'd be kind of capitulation, right? It'd be saying, well, I guess this ad thing ain't going to work. So, because it'll undermine your ad model.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, Google has, in a way, tried this music key. If you are a Google Music All Access subscriber, you probably already have this. You can apply for beta. When I click the music tab, the new music tab on my YouTube site, I get ad-free music, mixes, playlists. Just it's kind of like, you know, Spotify or Google All Access, except they're videos too, and I can even do these offline on my phone. So I can say, I want to hear all the pop music tracks. It'll start playing. There'll be no pre-roll. This is a playlist, and it'll just play forever on my phone or on my device. See, no pre-roll. Taylor Swift's getting nothing for this.
We'll see how it plays out. I mean, I think that the reality is...
Okay, you could turn the music down now.
We'll see. I mean, I think in the end of the day, when you do the kind of mass calculation, if you're a Google, what is Google's current like annual run rate revenue? I think it's around like $40 billion. Is that about right?
Yeah.
You know, these are such rounding errors.
Right.
And so the reality is, sure, maybe you can do something on a side project around music, removing ads, et cetera. Fine. But like, let's be really clear. Like, for the things that are core to their business, which is search and YouTube, they have to figure out how to make an ad model pay and focus on that. And everything else is really just noise.
Was this the music industry then that did this? I mean, most of these videos, in fact, all of them, it looks like, are from Vivo. I mean, why are they giving this away?
If I had to guess, and it is purely a guess.
Well, say it's $10 a month.
Right.
I think they're trying to get more people to subscribe to the Google Play Music subscription thing.
It's just a.
And this is magnifying. You know, this is magnifying the audience for that.
Right.
And that was some. I went to SF Music Tech last week, and the head of the Google Play Music was interviewed there, and she said that their subscriptions are growing and doing well, and they expect them to grow further. And I suspect that part of that was behind this. The thing is that the music. YouTube is a place people go to play music. It has been for a very long time, and the labels know this. And they've previously if you upload a song, if you upload a video that has a song on it, they'll content ID match it, and they'll put a buy this song link on it.
Right.
Google will get some referrer for that. And the labels will post videos up there with the assumption that people will play them there and then potentially buy the songs. But they also want some of this ongoing subscription revenue, which they're already getting from Google Play Music and from you know, the other services like that. And this is a way of extending that into that mode. So that one makes a lot of sense to me. I think the Google Contributor makes a bit less sense, but I can see why Google's doing it, because the crowdfunding models are starting to get some more traction, and this is a way to keep it inside their ecosystem. And the advantage they have is they already have the financial relationships with these publishers because they're running ads for them, and they can actually achieve micropayments. Whereas A lot of the value of the crowdfunding things is that they succeed better without micropayments. So I think Google's one fits in with their model. I'm not sure it necessarily fits in with the consumer's mental model. There's been a series of these things where you say, I will donate $10 a month to the sites I read. People have built those over the years, over the last 10 years, several times. And they don't tend to work that well because it is you have to get a lot of subscribers for that. And the actual successes in crowdfunding have been the ones where you let people pay variable amounts of money. So people can say, I really like this artist. I'd like to give them a lot of money. I really like this site. I'd like to give it a lot of money and work on that basis. So the fixed price aspect of it is I suspect, a downside to it.
It does look like there's a slider from $1 to $3.
That's
not a huge, huge difference. The more you contribute, the more you support the websites you visit. Yeah.
If you go to say Bandcamp, you can say, oh, I can buy this album for $6 or I can buy it for $300. And people do that for artists they really like.
I think that's a great idea. And I think you should give them that range. Somebody in our chat room suggests, Ken from Chicago, that this is really just a ploy to get credit card numbers. I think Google has plenty of credit card numbers.
Yeah, Google's got lots of credit card numbers. Mm-hmm. Google Play Store has got...
Yeah, they got several of mine in Google Wallet.
Yeah, so they have at least five of mine, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think they need to ploy. They need to ploy. Let's take a break. We're talking about the week's tech news with some really great people. It's nice to have... This is what I love about doing Twit, is I get people I'm interested in together to talk about stuff I'm interested in. Kevin Marks, Tim Stevens, and Sam Lesson. And we'll talk about the... Tim, get ready. We're going to talk about the LA Auto Show.
All right. Back. I'm ready.
Our show today brought to you by GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with clients and colleagues anywhere in the world. Who wants to travel these days? Business travel is no fun. Everybody's learned that. Travel's great. Business travel, not so hot. And not to mention expensive and time-consuming. And a conference call on the phone, or email, it's not going to make it either. This is why millions of professionals and businesses, large and small, use, and we do too, GoToMeeting from Citrix. You share your screen so you can all be on the same page. Great way to collaborate on documents, to present. You got a PowerPoint presentation, why people should buy your product. Great way to show it to clients. They appreciate it because you're not wasting as much of their time. And it's more effective. Plus, you could turn on the webcams, and now you're going to see each other in high-definition video. That makes it like meeting in person. GoToMeeting. You can engage. You can connect just like you're in the same room. Frankly, it's even better. I want you to try it today. See what it could do for your business. We use it for every meeting whenever we can. Try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Visit GoToMeeting.com. Click the Try It Free button. That's GoToMeeting.com for your 30-day free trial. I was on a GoToMeeting the other day, and I was wearing my jammies. So I put the camera pointing at the fireplace. So there's a nice little Yule log moment going on during the meeting. People appreciated that. They especially appreciated not seeing me in my jammies. GoToMeeting.com. Try it free today. If you missed this week on Twit, boy, we had some fun. Take a look.
Previously on Twit.
I'm worried. One of these days, a quadcopter is going to kill me.
Tech news tonight.
Uber senior vice president of business, Emil Michael, suggested that the company might consider hiring a team of opposition researchers to dig up dirt on media critics.
Before you buy.
The review of the Pono player really is much more than just a review of the player. It's really a discussion of, can music sound better?
This week in Google.
Uber has this thing called God View, allegedly.
Are you going to delete your Uber app?
My Uber app is deleted and said that I do not trust Uber with my data. So yeah, I'm done.
All about Android.
It is so awesome to just kind of say, okay, Google, and have the phone light up.
I'm positive yours is not the only phone that's going off right now.
You have to say, okay, Google, three times.
Every time I hear the beep, it's funnier.
No, stop, no.
Twit. It keeps going and going and going.
Next time you see me at this set again, these two turkeys back here will be gone.
What a day. What a week it's been. I got my Nexus 6 right here. Jeff Jarvis got his too. He did an informal Skype unboxing that was
a little wonky. But there it is, 6 inches. We'll do. I'll probably do a review on Before You Buy on Tuesday. I don't know. I brought all my phones just so I can see. There's the iPhone 6 Plus, and Galaxy Note 4. Not that much bigger than those. I have to say, though, it doesn't have all the features of the Moto X, which I really like, including the leather back.
How does it compare to the Nexus 7?
It's very close. It's almost just one little inch. Look, see? Maybe it's just me, but I don't mind a big phone. I like big phones.
Well, yeah, I've.
Doesn't look weird. That doesn't look weird. No. Well, we're used to it now.
I've never understood that objection because the distance between your ear and your mouth is about that long.
Right. It actually looks like an old-fashioned. Yeah. And it has left.
No one speaks on their phones anymore.
And who does this anyway, right? Right? Nobody talks on a phone to their ear.
So you basically take these two and sort of average them, and that's what you get.
Yeah. It's right in between the two.
So I could get rid of both of these, just carry one.
I'm a little disappointed. It doesn't have all the Moto X stuff, you can teach it a phrase, and it knows when you're driving. And my Moto X now, when I'm at home, says, you've got a call from, do you want to answer it? It's kind of nice. I like all those features. And it doesn't have the leather back or anything. I don't know. I can't decide. This is a tough year for phones. I wish I just were one of those simple-minded iPhone guys. It'd be a lot easier. iPhone.
That was my massive amusement when the new ones came out, and they were saying, like, big phones are really good, and I'm going, mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've been saying that for a couple of years. actually, I hate to admit it, but I really like the Note 4. It's got the best screen, arguably the best camera. I really like it. Little thumbprint.
Yeah, it's a great device.
Yeah.
I've been using one for a few weeks as well, and I did a really long-term comparison with that and the iPhone 6 Plus just because I really couldn't kind of make up my mind. But for me, actually, the productivity stuff they've added in, especially in the S Note application, has really come in handy.
Yeah.
For example, take a picture of a slide in a presentation if you're sitting in the audience, and it'll capture the slide. It'll reformat it to make it flat and then pull out the individual elements within that slide so you can then drag them around in your notes
it's
and
amazing.
Kind of draw arrows at them and stuff.
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive stuff. And the voice recording is really good for interviews, too, which is handy for me because I do all my interviews on my notes. So, yeah, it's definitely been a big step forward over the Note 3 for me.
And this is the only one of all of this bunch that you can just pry off the back. I bought a second battery, and you just pop in another battery, and you just keep going. Battery life is such an issue these days. Plus, the SD card means I don't have to worry about running out of it. I don't know.
I hope Samsung doesn't get rid of that feature. They seem to, they're getting there with the metal casing and the metal chassis, and I hope that this isn't the last Note with the replaceable battery, but I guess we'll see.
I hope Samsung doesn't go out of business. Didn't they say they're going to cut back on the number of phones to 30%? And they're
still like 500 new phones a year.
Yeah, there's still plenty. Have you played with the Edge yet?
I haven't used the Edge myself. No,
I'm starting to see reviews.
Yeah, it seems like a really interesting device, but with all the accessories that we're starting to see for the Note 4 and for the Galaxy S5, I don't think the Edge is going to get any of that treatment at all. I think it'll be kind of a cool phone to have, but ultimately, if you're looking for support, I wouldn't be surprised if that gets dropped real soon.
So you think Samsung might eliminate the pry-off back and the replaceable battery?
I don't know. I mean, there's such a strong push for thinner.
It does make it a little clunkier, doesn't it?
It does, but there's been some, so much blowback against Apple with the Bengate stuff that maybe Samsung will draw the line and say, this is thin enough. We don't need to go any thinner.
Right.
We're going to continue to maintain one of our biggest selling points, in my opinion, which is the removable battery. But yeah, it doesn't feel anywhere near as nice in the hand as the iPhone 6 Plus does, that's for sure.
No, or frankly, the Nexus 6, which really is got the rounded back and is a nice... For the size, it's a nice feel. I feel like battery life it really pisses me off because here's the Droid Turbo and the Nexus 6, both of which have monster batteries in them. And instead of saying, oh, great, let's make a long life phone, we'll keep the 1080p screen. Instead, they say, oh, well, we got so much battery life. Why don't we just, let's put in a quad HD screen. And then the battery life's back to the same, 12 hours everything else is. I want to go all day, darn it. And we know this is the case because the OnePlus One, which is a 1080p screen, fine screen, does go 20 hours with a big battery. So it's possible, but they just have decided.
I've got one of those. I like it a lot.
Isn't it a great phone?
Yeah. Yeah. It's too big for me. I like little phones. But I do like it. I think it's a really solid device.
I would say that if you can get it, and that's the only limitation, is it's hard to get, at $350 for the 64 gig version with a 20-hour battery life, and if, you know, in every other respect, it's, I don't know how long it's going to be before Lollipop because it's Cyanogen. But Cyanogen Mod is great. That is the phone. If that were widely available, I would say without hesitation, that's the Android phone to get this year.
I think it's great. When I first got it, I didn't have a SIM card in it, and I just like left it on. It literally lasted on without a SIM card in it, so that's a big deal, for almost a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is awesome, right?
Did you say, Tim, people are having trouble with the OnePlus?
Yeah, I've seen a few people with issues with the display flickering and some weird refresh rates and some other issues. So I don't think their quality control is quite up to snuff.
Well, and there's no support, right? Because you call them, right. Who are you going to get?
Yeah, exactly. And if they're having this much of a problem meeting supply now, how long will it take you to get a replacement device or break? So I'd be a little bit concerned there.
I don't know. I can't decide what my daily driver is going to be. I just don't know.
Well, so that's the thing, because I'm a big fan of the Nexus 7, but it's obviously not a phone, and it's just that little bit too big for most pockets.
You would like the 6.
So I would... So.
And Lollipop's
that's
awesome.
Why OnePlus One sounds attractive, because having that, you know, that many pixels in a slightly smaller size with a battery that lasts longer sounds very attractive.
The latest DisplayMate results are in today. DisplayMate makes, of course, software to rank color accuracy and help calibrate your screens. Raymond Sonera, who's the president over there, loves doing these. And I think we could, I don't know. I feel like, look, it's got charts. We should be able to trust this. see, there's charts. It's got to be true. But he says that if you look at the 6 flagship smartphones and tablets out there, the clear winner is what would you guess? Clear winner is the Note 4 by far. Now, I think it makes sense because Samsung makes their own displays. So it makes sense that they probably reserve the best displays for themselves.
And they also give you the power to tweak the display settings on the phone itself, which is a big advantage too if you're looking to get really accurate color.
Yeah. The most accurate color, very beautiful. The Galaxy Note 4, when it's set in the basic screen mode, has the best full gamut color accuracy. Skin tone accuracy far beyond that of any other phone. Same with organic color accuracy. You know, it's pretty impressive. If you look at the white point, 0.0007... that's so much ahead of anybody else. It's not even close. Where's the iPhone on here? The iPhone is 0.0087. So it's like 10 times better. Anyway, there you go. There's the results. The results are in. The standard full color gamut is best in the, does that help on the Note 4? Do you care? Does anybody really care? How important is color accuracy really?
It's important if you're actually using it as a reference for something else. Yeah. And that's when you need a calibrated monitor. But,
and when it comes to tablets, Microsoft Surface Pro 3. Kind of close to the Galaxy Tab from Samsung.
I actually visited the testing facility of the Surface Pro 3 before they launched it, and they spent a lot of time talking about how much effort they put into color calibration and making sure that display is perfect. So,
who is that for? Is that photographers that care about that? I mean, who really cares about that?
Yeah, photographers for sure. But you know, you have to remember that color accuracy doesn't necessarily relate to an appealing design or appealing display for a lot of people. You know, if you walk into Best Buy and look at TVs, the color settings on those TVs are terrible, but they're designed to really catch your eyes as you're walking by, make everything look warm and comfortable. And that's kind of what we're seeing here. You know, accuracy doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be the best looking display to the naked eye necessarily.
So tell us about Tim Stevens. Tell us about the LA Auto Show. First of all, is this a big... I know Detroit's a big auto show. Is L.A. as big as important as the Detroit auto show?
Not quite, but it's definitely getting bigger and getting more important over the years. Detroit is still the big U.S. show for sure, and one of the biggest shows internationally. But L.A. is definitely getting big, especially with a lot of tech announcements. You know, more and more auto manufacturers are choosing to make their tech-related announcements at CES these days. But we did see quite a few here in L.A., or there in L.A. I'm back in New York now, thankfully. One of the big ones being Android Auto, which is, you know, Google's option for being able to connect your phone to your car and use it in a safe way. They opened up the APIs for developers. They announced them back at Google I/O over the summer, But now they're publicly available, and you can actually start to launch and deploy your apps that will run within the car. So they announced quite a few apps that have been out there that are compatible now. Spotify on the audio side is a nice one. WhatsApp on the text messaging side. And, you know, you're probably thinking text messaging while you're driving is
not a good idea.
And indeed it is. But what Google's done is basically define templates for each of these apps. So as you go from Spotify to Songs or SoundCloud, all the apps look exactly the same. And so basically these app developers are just kind of plugging in their functionality into the template that Google has defined.
Now, this is different than like the Ford Sync, which is a computer and software built into the car, right?
Right. Basically, all this does is it turns your car into kind of a dumb terminal for your phone.
It's a screen. It's a second screen.
Right. And then everything really happens between either a very simple interface, which would be on Spotify, for example, skip track, you know, next track, thumbs up, thumbs down, that kind of thing. Or in text messaging, it would all be read to you through the text-to-speech. And then if you wanted to do a simple reply, it would be, again, voice back to text. So there'd be no distracting displays on there, no emails popping up, no text messages on your car that you need to read. It would all be read to you, or if it's too distracting, it simply wouldn't happen at all. So the idea is you put your phone down, you connect to your car, the phone is disabled, so you have no temptation to pick it up whatsoever, and you get these simplified interfaces that allow you to play your Spotify playlists or listen to your text messages, that kind of thing.
Apple's doing the same.
The phone is disabled then?
The phone is disabled. Phone? Yep, it's still charging up.
No one's going
to
want that.
I want my phone!
Well, that might be what saves you a while, but I can't. Could you imagine personally if you told me that when I got in my car, my phone would be turned off? I'd freak out.
Well, it's not turned off though. You just have a different interface to it, right?
Yeah,
right.
But it sounds like a less expressive interface.
Well, yeah, because you're driving, Sam.
Interface, yes. You're in studies showing that if you use your phone while you're driving, it's as bad as drunk driving. So ultimately,
I agree with that, and that makes 100% sense to me. And I still feel like as a consumer, if you told me the good news is you have a screen, the bad news is your phone is disabled, people will not be very happy about
that's interesting. Can you turn it off, Tim? Can you say don't take over? I'm sure you can. Pair it.
You cannot. Exactly. If you don't want to use the service, then you certainly don't have to. But ultimately, this now is giving you some incentive to actually have your phone be disabled. Because before, you know, there are apps from Sprint or from other companies that will disable your phone while you're driving, but you don't get anything out of it. Now, at least when you plug it in, your phone is charging and you can get an interface to your apps in a safe way. You can still listen to Spotify. You can still get your emails read to you. You can still get directions to your next meeting and things like that without having to pick up your phone and crash into a school bus and kill innocent children.
I get it. Just saying.
No, I think, Sam, you're exactly right. I think that's the kind of thing. Now, Sam, you probably drive a Tesla, so you have a 17-inch screen in your console there.
No, I drive an A3 manual, so I actually have to use both my hands.
That's another way to do it. Have a stick shift, and then you don't have to. Although I guarantee you there are people who are texting and shifting at the same time. I guarantee you. I might
be
one of them.
You're right. I've seen some pretty amazing things at stoplights.
Hey, you're at a stoplight. That's the time you should do that. What about the hydrogen fuel cell cars? Toyota showed a car that I think they're going to start selling in Japan that has the explosive power of the Hindenburg. That's exciting.
It was interesting. It was a big show for fuel cells, and fuel cell cars are something that we've known are interesting, but ultimately weren't really sure if they were ever going to come to market because there's the huge question of where do you get the hydrogen to put into your car. Right now, there are all of, I think, 12 stations in all of California to fill up your car. There's 18 in the entire country of Germany to fill up your car if you have a hydrogen-powered car. So that's the big issue, but the technology, that was the big story of the show, is that technology for hydrogen for fuel cell cars is there, is ready. I got to drive the Volkswagen. And there was also an Audi there. And yeah, Toyota showed off their Mirai, which will be available for sale next year. They didn't say how much it's going to cost. Probably very expensive, in the order of $60,000. But you get a fully featured car, basically 300 miles of range on about 5 kilograms of hydrogen. And that equates to roughly 60 miles per kilogram, which is actually roughly equivalent to 60 miles per gallon. Which doesn't really sound, you know, it sounds good, but it doesn't really sound that great compared to a lot of hybrids out there. But the thing is, a kilogram of hydrogen costs about $2 right now. So that's, you know, roughly half the cost of a gallon of gas.
Yeah.
And that's with such limited supply. You can imagine if there were hydrogen stations on every corner, they think that cost could drop significantly. So these cars are going to be very expensive, and it's going to be very hard to fill them up. But, you know, they're zero emission. The only thing that comes out of the tailpipe is it is water vapor. They have decent power. They're, you know, as comfortable and as easy to drive as any other car, and they're significantly cheaper to run. So there's a lot of potential there, but we're still waiting for that that supply to be there for hydrogen. So, you know, who knows when that's going to happen.
I have so many questions. So it's not burning hydrogen. It's a fuel cell.
Right. So the hydrogen goes into a fuel cell, which gives you a constant supply of electricity, which isn't a lot of electricity, but it's enough to power the car.
So it's essentially an electric car.
Yes. These cars are all EVs. Basically, just think of, instead of having a big battery pack, you have a hydrogen tank connected to a fuel cell. Same idea. They do have small batteries, though, because the, you know, if you put your foot down, the demand is going to be greater than that fuel cell can supply. So they're kind of like hydrogen-powered hybrids almost. In fact, the Audi that they showed off is a plug-in hybrid. So you can actually plug that in at home and drive it for, I think, about 30 miles before it even starts to sip from the hydrogen tank. But yeah, they are all EVs, just like a battery-powered car.
So they're like the Volt then, that they have an engine as well, or they'd be plug-in hybrid? I mean, nothing's just hydrogen full fuel cell only, or is it?
The only source of electricity for most of these cars is from the hydrogen
fuel
cell.
Okay.
The Audi can be plugged in, too, to give you a little bit of extra range on top of that. But they have a small battery just to meet peak demand. So if you're going up a hill, if you're, you know, if you're racing somebody at the stoplight, that kind of thing, the fuel cell won't be able to give you enough juice to give you good acceleration.
And is there another consumable? I mean, doesn't a fuel cell require some sort of electrolysis process?
No, the maintenance on these things is remarkably low. There are some fuel filters and things that would need to be replaced every couple of years.
So there's no catalyst or
anything. But no, you don't have to drop in copper into the fuel tank or anything like that. They're pretty self-sustained. And, you know, these are still early days for these cars. So even at $60,000, Toyota's probably taking a bit of a loss just to get them on the market to see, you know, how they hold up to day-to-day wear and tear and weather and seasons and that kind of thing. But ultimately, you know, they're based on production technology. In fact, the Volkswagen cars are basically the same thing as the Volkswagen e-Golf. They're all electric Golf they're selling now. Just instead of having a battery pack, they've got a hydrogen tank.
And I was being jocular, referring to the Hindenburg. Of course, a gas tank is also highly combustible.
Right.
It's way worse, because if hydrogen leak, it just goes up in the sky and vanishes. Petroleum goes across the ground and because it's heavier than air, and then you light it and you get a flame that spreads sideways. So, yeah, petroleum gas spillage is one of the scariest things there is.
Anything that has enough stored energy to motivate a 3-ton vehicle is going to have some explosive power, even lithium ion. I mean, it's just you're storing a lot of energy in a compact form to drive the car. It's going to have some explosive potential.
We've seen plenty of battery packs go up in smoke, and when they do, they go very quickly and very violently. Mm-hmm. Not as violently as a hydrogen explosion, obviously. Right. But these tanks are very, very well designed. They're carbon fiber for the most part, and they can survive a pretty significant impact for sure.
And then the refueling, I guess Toyota said they're going to put in more stations. They say it fills in 5 minutes, which is pretty fast. It's faster than a Tesla, but not as fast as a gas fill-up.
Not quite. Yeah, you can figure you probably fill up a typical car in about 2 minutes. But one of the nice things is there's actually already a standard defined for hydrogen filling stations, so they don't need to do that. If you look at EVs, there are, I think, about 3 or 4 different standards as you go from one country to the next, which is a major headache for everybody. Tesla's got their own thing that they're doing. This is one standard defined across the entire industry, so that's nice. That's one of the things that you don't need to worry about. But yeah, you plug the car in, it takes about 5 minutes. You've got to go up to, I think, about 10,000 PSI, which is pretty high. But then at that point, you're good to go for another 300 miles.
And then finally, I guess the question that really we should be asking is, how do you produce hydrogen? And is it produced in an environmentally friendly way? Or is it just deferring the environmental cost to another location?
Yeah, and that really depends on where you are and where your electricity comes from. You can get hydrogen pretty easily from alcohol, from ethanol, that kind of thing. And that's pretty straightforward conversion in a pretty efficient way. You can also basically make it straight from thin air just by using electricity. But of course, the question there is, where is your electricity coming from? Right now, that is basically just kind of passing the buck from one source of contaminants, one source of pollution to another one. But, you know, the hope is at some point in the not too distant future, we'll have much more efficient sources of power to the grid. And then at that point, hydrogen production could, in theory, become free or close to free. And, you know, we're basically solving a lot of problems, which is all these cars on the road polluting.
Right.
And then kind of moving that problem up the stream a bit to power plants. And at that point, we can solve that problem. and move along. But again, it depends where you're from. If you're in the Northwest, for example, there's a lot of renewable energy up there. But if you're coming from a coal-fired power plant kind of place, you're probably just passing the buck.
Right. Interesting. What else did you see? Somebody was asking how you feel about the new Shelby Plank, what was it, differential? I don't know if that's in your purview or not.
Yeah, so the GT350, which is Ford's new, it's the first.
You can ask this guy anything.
it's their new. It's the first of what we'll probably see dozens and dozens of special edition Mustangs over the course of the run. But you know, they've just launched the new 2015 Mustang. This is the Shelby GT350. They didn't give us a lot of details about it. But basically the shape of the crank in the V8 means it's going to be a higher revving motor than what we've seen in the past. You know, usually you think of V8s as being big kind of throttly engines you wouldn't want to rev too high. This one will be designed for high revving, and it's basically designed to be a bit of a track toy. They're going after the Camaro Z28 in a big way. It's going to be over 500 horsepower. They didn't say exactly how many horsepower, but it's going to be a very nice car. Sounds very nice when it revs, and that crank, that the flat plane crank, gives it a different sort of sound to the ignition as well. But a very different sort of Mustang than what we've seen in the past, and I'm curious to see how it is on the track, especially with the new independent rear suspension, which is pretty sweet, too.
You see? You ask about flat plane cranks, and you get an answer. This man knows his stuff.
Thank you very much.
Tim Stevens. And you're going to do this. You'll probably cover this on CNET, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We'll be doing more Mustang coverage as soon as we can get a little bit more time behind the wheel. We did a big feature at the launch of that car last year. I went to Detroit to talk to the designers and kind of get a feel for things. Like I said, this is the first big special edition of the Mustang that they've done, but they'll be doing a lot more. And we hope to be spending some time on the track with that thing in the not too distant future.
That sounds awesome.
And the new Corvette, too. Actually, there's look for some more coverage of the new Z06 around CES time. That should be a lot of fun, too.
CNET.com/topics/car-tech. You can read all about it. I came this close to buying a Shelby, and then Tony Wang said, it's a waste. You shouldn't get a Shelby. You'll never drive it. So I just got a regular GT. But it's a nice car. It's a nice car.
Worse.
Yeah, it's got a stick, so I can't
nice.
Test. Yeah. 506 horsepower, is that right, on the flat crank? Holy cow.
Somewhere over 500, yeah. They didn't say how much it's going to cost, though, which is a big question for a lot of people.
Yeah, those Shelbys can be very expensive. Let's take a break. We'll come back with more. Lots more to talk about. Tim Stevens, Sam Lesson, Mr. Kevin Marks. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com and kind of in a way by the Post Office, the U.S. Postal Service. Because if you are doing mailing in your business, if you're sending out brochures or if you sell on Etsy or eBay or Amazon, you don't want to go to the post office this time of year. You don't have time to go to the post office. It's going to be packed. Everybody's mailing holiday gifts and packages. I got a mailer from the post office on Friday saying how to be a postal pro, how to navigate the traffic and the parking. Stamps.com. I should have just said, hey, you don't have to send me this anymore. I have Stamps.com. I don't have to go to the post office anymore. I can buy and print my own U.S. postage on demand from my computer, my printer, 24/7. I can print postage for any letter, any package, the instant I need it. The mail carrier comes to my house, picks me up, and I love this USB scale because that means you always have exactly the right postage. I'm the kind of guy, because I don't want to send stuff postage due, so I'll always put an extra stamp or two on. You know, that's a waste of money. And, of course, a lot worse if you send stuff postage due. That is not that's frowned upon, I think. Bad etiquette if you're trying to promote or talk about something cool and exciting and the poor customer gets a postage due envelope. That doesn't bode well for your business. Use Stamps.com. You'll even save money. You can get discounts you can't get at the post office, a priority mail, and priority mail express shipments. One click of the mouse, and you've got package insurance from Stamps.com. They'll even fill out all the forms for international and certified mail, all the customs stuff. It's just really great. You don't have to copy and paste data. It'll take it right from QuickBooks or your address book or Amazon or eBay or Etsy. I just love it. Stamps.com. Here's the deal. Go to Stamps.com. Click the microphone in the upper right-hand corner and use our offer code TWIT, and you will get a very good offer, $110 bonus offer. It includes that scale. You pay $5 shipping and handling on that, but you also get $55 in postage coupons. And a $5 supply kit. Plus, of course, a month free of Stamps.com. You got to try it. Stamps. Apple.com. Use the offer code TWIT for our special deal. Good news, Apple has ended the patent war. Whoever thought that would happen? Remember, Apple was a primary investor in a company called Rockstar. They bought the Nortel patents? You would know about this, Kevin, being a telecom fellow. And they, in fact, up in Canada, they had a Rockstar had a lab with people reverse engineering all sorts of technology looking for patent infringement. Apple was a big investor. And I think Microsoft was involved in Rockstar and was suing everybody, especially Samsung. The Rockstar lawsuits were kind of the latest in a nonstop lawsuit mania going on in Silicon Valley. Apple, and I have to think this is Tim Cook, has decided to end this war. Remember, this was Steve Jobs who declared thermonuclear war on Google and Android. Good news, Kevin?
Definitely good news. I mean, the less of this nonsense there is, the better.
Yeah.
Because it's basically just a way for lawyers to tax technology, as far as I can tell. No company ends up doing well out of this.
But doesn't a company, I'm going to play devil's advocate, have a right and obligation to protect their intellectual property?
Well, the notion of intellectual property itself is a problematic one. So there's...
A commie.
No, it's a post-hoc construction. There are three separate things that have been tied together as intellectual property and promoted as a form of property, as opposed to government-granted monopolies designed to have a function. And once you treat them as property, then people's metaphor for them is broken. The point of patents was to protect the invention for a limited time and then make it public. That was also the point of copyright. Copyright, they kept extending the term to the point of ridiculousness, so that making it public thing doesn't happen anymore.
thank you, Walt Disney.
Yep. With patents, what happened is that they effectively changed the definition of invention from something that has to sort of practically exist to the ability to patent abstract ideas. And that's when we had the explosion of idiocy there.
Is that software patents? Is that really the fundamental issue?
Software patents, business model patents. There's a whole
swipe to unlock. You can't patent swipe to unlock. Come on.
Things like that. So design patents as well.
Yeah.
So the challenge with part of this is a culture clash. So the reason that the telecom companies were very big on patents was because the model that they had for standardization was that. They very much wanted the whole industry to have the same standard. As you were talking about with the fuel cells, you want everyone to be on the same standard for something like that. And so the model they did come up with was that you would get all the engineers from every company together, agree the standards up front, create a patent pool, cross license it, and that was their workaround for that. And that worked. That works well in their domain, where you have to express these things in hardware, and there are very long lead times in building them. So when you want to go from GSM to 4G, you want everyone to be building the same chips and actually have them interoperable. So that's the sort of worldview they came from. And that sort of leaked into technology at the point where we were working with audio-video codecs and things like that. And that became the notion of standardization sort of leaks across from there. So as these technologies shifted from being implemented purely in hardware to being potentially implemented in software, that there's a culture clash between the two modes, and that's where a lot of this comes from. And so, you know, in the software world, we long ago realized that this was unworkable and came up with other models for getting people to converge, which is open source and open standards models, open standards groups like the IETF and W3C. Where we all agree, we still go and argue about it, but it's not an upfront agreement where we say we will agree on how this will work before we build it. It's much more often a post hoc agreement. We're saying, okay, we've all built these things that are fairly close. If we make a few small changes, then we'll actually interoperate better. And if you look at the difference between the ISO, for example, and the W3C or even the IETF, the ISO is this effectively behaves like a legislative body, and the W3C and the IETF behave much more like documenting what has happened and agreeing to so that future people can do the same thing. So they've taken the responsibility for documenting the invention from the patent, which was designed to let someone else replicate it after it expired, into this this publicly shared process where we can replicate it at before it's expired, so that we've got a layer of stuff we can agree on. So that difference is key to the heart of this. And a lot of these patent wars were sort of leakage from that hardware-centric worldview into the software worldview. And I think what the promising thing we're now seeing is the leakage is going the other way as we're starting to get more open source hardware, but also as software replaces a lot of the things that we used to do in hardware, the ability to use open source stuff for that and open spec stuff for that becomes much more viable.
IAM, which is the blog arm of the IP Media Group, Richard Lloyd writing, says that Rockstar reached a settlement with Cisco. They have now settled with Google. He calls them an NPE, which is the modern term for patent troll, non-practicing entity, somebody that bought patents but has no desire to use them, merely to sue. They've also apparently dropped lawsuits against others. Apparently, the investors in Rockstar, which include Apple, which put $2.6 billion into it in 2011, have kind of lost their appetite for suing, for fighting. The real question is, what will happen to Rockstar? Will it be sold to another non-practicing entity? That would be bad. But it seems to be that the parties involved, the investors, don't want that to happen. If they do sell Rockstar's assets, they'll sell to somebody else who's not going to sue. Apple, Ericsson, BlackBerry, Microsoft, Sony, and EMC bid for it. I think EMC was not involved, but Sony, Microsoft, BlackBerry, Apple, and Ericsson are the parties. And since Ericsson and BlackBerry are resting, it's probably really more up to Sony, Microsoft, and Apple right now.
Right, and at some point, you know, Apple has sort of won the battle.
No need to fight. So it's not merely Tim Cook saying, you know, this was a bad idea, it's bad for everybody. Lots of things about how we do business were revealed in these lawsuits. It's him saying we won.
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I think it is a change of tone. Apple has been historically fairly litigious and also been the target of a lot of patent lawsuits as well.
Yeah.
So they've got a very strong legal team, and it's a question of which way they're deciding to point them.
Of course, ironically, you'd think Samsung would say, oh, thank goodness. No, instead, they're countersuing NVIDIA and Velocity Micro. NVIDIA suing them over the system on a chips used for the Shield tablet, the Tegra K1 and the Tegra 2. Well.
So, I mean, the other thing is, the way to think about Apple, and this is the thing that the area that Tim Cook is extremely good at, is they want to commoditize the stuff that they're putting the layer on top of.
Right.
So for any given Apple model they make, they will have multiple suppliers for the different components, and they'll decide as they ramp up to production which ones they're going to go with. And that was definitely true when I was at Apple. When they were building new machines, there were always multiple builds with different hardware components for the different pieces, so they could try them out. We could get the software running on all of them, and then they could swap out suppliers as needed. And as they've scaled up, that may have been harder for them to do. But it's something that, you know, this is the piece that Tim Cook grew with the supply side of Apple and understands that.
Right.
And in some ways, that's what Apple's doing with other industries as well. If you think about the way Apple Pay works, in effect, they're doing the same thing. They're saying, okay, the payment models are all interchangeable. We're just providing a layer on top of that.
That's smart.
As you swap that out. Yeah.
We add the value to, commodity backends.
Yeah. We add the design and the user experience and the large customer base that likes what we do to your service layer.
Right. European Parliament is poised to call for a breakup of Google. That's a good idea. The idea, I guess, is to put political pressure on the European Commission to take a tougher stand on Google antitrust and anti-privacy investigations. The Financial Times report that it saw a draft motion from the European Parliament that says, quote, unbundling of search engines from other commercial services should be considered as a potential solution to Google's dominance. That, Sam, that must be frustrating for a company when you have all this success and all you get is, well, in that case, we're going to break you up.
I mean, I don't know the details of of how the European Commission documents are kind of tearing out. My sense is like, look, I think it's actually not that dissimilar to the Uber situation at some abstract level, which is when you get big enough, everyone says a lot of different things and there's a lot of opinions. And the question is, how do you manage this at scale and kind of move forward? Is it unfathomable that at least one or more people in Europe think this is a good idea? No, there's a lot of people in Europe. Like, the question is, like, you know, how does it actually end up netting out at the end of the day? I don't know. But I don't know how – it's not clear to me how serious this is versus how much this is – there's a lot of drafts of a lot of things in the world.
Yeah. Google apparently was furious at the political nature of the motion. They don't think it's a serious motion. They just think it's politics in the European Union.
So – the question is, how do you manage these huge companies and these huge systems where, you know, everyone has a very personal relationship with these brands and they're powerful?
Right.
But the other thing is that this sort of maps a bit to the structural separation solution that I was talking about for net neutrality. That's a model that Europe understands for that size that they're trying to apply in this field. And the challenge is that an analogy that works, or is there another analogy that makes more sense? And the question needs to be, which is better for the end users, for the people. And most of these suits in the EU have not been by people saying Google search is really bad. It's been by people saying
it's too good.
Google search is too good. It's locking us out.
Yeah.
And that's the pattern there.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge for the EU Commission is to come up with a way that says, okay, what we actually changed that would make this better for customers. The other parallel may be the Microsoft consent decree, where they said, we didn't like you bundling the browser with the operating system, and so we're going to mandate that you give the users a choice of browsers.
Yeah, that worked out well. The browser ballot. That was nice.
So, you know, that coincided with Microsoft, like, sort of sending the IE team out on holiday for 2 years. So it's not clear how much impact that had compared to the fact that other people were building better browsers and Microsoft was resting on their laurels. But, you know, the browser market has changed since then.
Lest you think venal and stupid politicians exist only in Europe, good news, after the Supreme Court decision against Aereo, they've conceded defeat and Aereo now is filing for bankruptcy. For some time, they tried to convince the court, no, okay, we'll be a cable company then. The court didn't buy it. Aereo, which is only 3 years old and was beloved by people who used the service, has basically been put out of business by the television networks who didn't like the idea one bit. 5 months ago, they lost in the Supreme Court, and they haven't really been able to find a way out. So they're going to seek bankruptcy protection. It is Chapter 11, so it doesn't mean they're going away, just restructuring. But I got to wonder... What exactly their new business model will be if you can't do
Look,
it.
Look, they made a bet and it came up wrong.
They took a chance
for them.
Yeah.
But it was a cool bet.
It's a cool bet. How do you feel about that Supreme Court decision? Did you, I mean, I, it seemed I misguided.
I don't know. I mean, it depends. Look, the reality is I think this goes back to the whole – my best grounding in all this stuff is I really, really enjoyed The Master Switch as a book. I recommend everyone read it who's interested in it.
These are all the forces at work, aren't they? Yeah.
It's all just kind of rehashing very old issues over and over and over again. And I think it's like a reasonable outcome for the Supreme Court to pull. Like, it's not irrational.
No.
But it just pushes the world in a little bit of a different direction for a while.
For a while is kind of the key, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the thing, the Aereo was always a bit of a hack anyway.
They knew what they were. They knew what they were doing.
We're going to put tiny antennas on top of buildings so you have one each. It's like,
yeah.
What? Yeah.
And it was always a temporary play because as soon as internet broadcasting over the top happens, you don't need Aereo, right? It's just a matter of it was an interim product until local stations put themselves on the internet. And that's going to happen.
That's going to happen too. I mean, I've gone the other way. I've cancelled my Comcast cable subscription and put an antenna on the side of the house. And so, if you want to watch anything over the air, we'll watch it on the antenna. Otherwise, we'll just use Netflix and. You know,
but you're lucky; Google, you can get free broadcast over the air. We can't get OTA up here in Petaluma. We got.
But what do you? I mean, I'm actually curious. I mean, do you guys watch sports? For me, I don't watch sports, and so I literally we haven't had any sort of connection to anything live in years, and it's never been an issue.
Sports, Academy Awards.
There's the occasional thing.
It's live programming, right?
Yeah, The Voice, stuff like that, yeah.
The Voice? Really?
Rosie really likes The Voice.
Lisa watches The Voice. She drives me crazy because she DVRs it. And that's sensible because there's like 8 hours of commercials in every hour of television. I don't know how they do it. It's an amazing miracle. she skips right to the performances. And I said, well, but I want to see what Garth says. That's Taylor Swift. She goes right to the performances.
That's pretty sensible. That would make it like a 10-minute show.
It's a very short show. It takes no time to watch.
If that's all she wants, she could just get those off iTunes because those are on iTunes.
Shh. It makes her happy to fast forward the DVR.
Okay.
Explain to me streaming Photoshop. Actually, we're going to talk about that in a second. Take a break. And then I want to talk about, I think it's pronounced, I wanted to say Hoya, but I think it's Hola or Jola, the open source iPad alternative, raised $1 million in 2 days. This is from a bunch of ex-Nokia employees. The chairman of the FCC says, we're not going to rush. We're going to take our time. Don't rush me, man. Our show today brought to you by Hover.com, the best way to get those domain names. Now, you understand how the domain name system works. There's a ICANN, which then gives registrars the ability to register domain names and take that registration and then send them to the big, you know, canonical DNS servers where it propagates down. But you have to get a domain. You can't just go to ICANN and say, give me a domain name. You have to buy it from a registrar. And you have many choices of registrars, but I got to tell you, after trying them all, I love Hover. Hover is the easiest, the best way to not only get the domain names, but to manage them. You don't get all that upsell and all that extra clicks. Some of these places you buy a domain name and then you have to click 53 times just to get to the checkout. Hover's fast and easy. So if you've got an idea for a domain name, you go to hover.com. You're going to get that domain name right away. Right now is a great time to start a new project. Hover has recently lowered prices on more than 200 domain extensions, including many of the top-level domains. They also reduced the price for new .com domain names. It's $12.99, but that includes Whois privacy, because they know you don't want your name and phone number and address published on the internet, so they give that to you for free with every domain that supports it. Hover is so great. It takes the friction out of registering a domain name. Their valet transfer service makes it easy. I should have used it. I did it myself. That was a nightmare. But I did transfer all my services over to Hover. If I'd used the valet transfer service, they would have taken care of the whole thing for you. Let you know when you... Some domain registrars are loath to let go of your business. They'll lock your domain for months and say, you can't transfer out of here, boy. They're supposed to let you, but believe me, they don't make it easy. Hover will take care of it for you, and then they'll tell you when your domains are in there. They'll transfer the DNS settings, and it's free no matter how many domain names you have. You pay $10, you get a year extension no matter what the domain name is. I love it. Hover, honest, straightforward. They have the best customer support around. They're famous for their no-wait, no-hold, no-transfer phone service, and they offer volume discounts. So if you're buying a bunch of domains, as few as 10, they'll give you a discount on your renewals. Hover.com. I invite you to use them today. On your first purchase, you'll get 10% off when you use the promo code TWIT11. TWIT11. It's the 11th month at HOVER.com. You're going to love them. I watched the video and I forgot now how you pronounce it. Is it Jola? Hola?
It's Yola.
Yola? It's a Sailfish OS, which is a skinned version, I believe, of Android. They're doing, here it is, the Indiegogo campaign. They want to make an iPad alternative. November 19th, they started. They were hoping to get $380,000. To date, $1.1 million on the say it again, Jola? Hola?
Yola.
Yola. It's Finnish, right?
Finnish.
Yola. To a better and more open place. So what do you think of this?
I think it was great. This is based on Linux, so it can run Android apps, but of course you won't get the first party, you know, your Gmails, your Google Maps, and that sort of thing. But you know that you can run Android apps helps a lot.
Will it be AOSP or is it? It's something completely different.
It's similar, closest to Migo, actually, if you remember.
Oh, the Migo, yeah, yeah.
Years ago. So it's kind of similar a little bit, at least in feel to that. But it's a very nice OS from what I've seen. I haven't actually used it myself. This is version 2. I think version 1 was on the phone that I think came out last year, if I remember right.
Yeah, I had a Migo phone briefly. That was it. That was done, right?
Yeah, that was kind of a last splash for Migo in the N9, which everybody loved, and then, no, unfortunately, it was never followed up by anything. I went to Windows Phone after that. But the tablet looks nice. I think it's a nice price point. Obviously, a lot of people are interested and excited. It's kind of interesting to see it's almost like a spiritual successor to a lot of Nokia devices, which I think is a
It looks a little like a Lumia, doesn't it, with that curved edge? Yeah.
Yep.
So you can get, if you do the Indiegogo for $209, they plan to charge $250. So it's very affordable.
Yeah, it's a great price.
Yeah. I have to say, after using the Fire OS and these other, I just feel like you really should just get Android or iOS. A forked OS is, I mean, I'd love to support these guys. I think it's great. I don't know.
The likelihood they'll be able to succeed at scale is extremely thin. I mean, it's just like, it's so expensive. Not the one-time build of any of these things, but continuously updating them, keeping them competitive, getting distribution. I mean, this is extremely difficult. To pull off.
I know.
So, basically, I would argue basically impossible for a startup.
I mean, I want to support them. I love the idea. These are all refugees from Nokia trying to make their way in the world. You know what they need? They need some hook. They need to say, like, it's the private tablet, you know? Like the black phone or something. They need some hook that makes you want it, that it's better somehow than Android or iOS. Otherwise, just I don't understand why you wouldn't get a mainstream OS.
It's also unclear. I mean, starting with building a tablet is an interesting decision. I guess on one hand, it's less mission critical, so people are willing to buy an extra
take
one.
Take a chance. Yeah.
And take a chance. Who cares, right? But on the flip side, it's, you know, especially in this world you guys are playing with your huge phones, it's really unclear to me that a tablet is like a meaningful form factor in the future.
I wonder. Really? Now, that's very – you're taking a chance. You're getting out on the ledge here.
I'll throw it out there.
Really? I feel the same way, but I, you know, look at iPad sales. They're kind of flattened, turning down.
Yep.
When you have a 6-inch phone, what do you need a tablet for?
Especially these small tablets. This guy's 7.85 inches, which is, you know, very, very close to the bigger phones these days, the Nexus 6 or the Note 4. If anything, I think we'll see the iPad and its ilk kind of getting bigger, moving up to the 12-inch, the 14-inch size, you know, just to maintain some sort of a niche. Ultimately, that's still going to be a smaller niche. I think the tablet sales are going to continue to decline. But ultimately, if you've got a 6-inch phone in your pocket, why do you need an 8-inch tablet in your hand? You'd want something significantly different, and that would be the only reason to have a tablet, really.
But I got to say, they've raised $1 million+. I mean, somebody wants it.
So, I mean, my point of view on this is that these things are actually converging. It's not that, you know, the phone-tablet dichotomy was basically a design decision that Apple made a few years ago based on the technology at the time. And that sort of got baked into the way people thought about these things as separate entities, whereas now there's a continuum. You can, you know, Samsung has a thing at every measurement between 3 inches and 12. And people can pick the ones out that they want to use. And the software is moving now. Apple has finally shipped some bigger phones from that dichotomy to this continuous, you know, responsive design model. And I think it's just a question of picking which size thing you want to be using at the moment.
That's fair. I think the only argument I'd make contrary to that is just that there is a very different relationship you have with your phone versus a tablet, which might be shared in a family or kind of used in a home by multiple people. To me, it's, you know, you guys are, and I myself, I'm here too. You know, I have two phones, massive exception to the rule. Like, people are going to have like a device. And that's just a very different pattern of having a device that's your persistent identity and login and experience of the world that's with you all the time and has to be ready to be carried with you everywhere versus a tablet, which is a casual use at home, around the couch, shared by a family, whatever. So I think there is a different pattern of interaction, at least historically.
I got to say, when you look around now at people, they are in love with their phone. They don't look at their loved ones. They don't look at their food. They don't look at the road. They are in love. Aren't they? And I'm one of them. We gaze into the eyes of our phone with passion. This is what people want. This is there's the most intimate technology in history.
But I think the other thing is that we're starting to get them the notion that you can move the snuff between the screens is becoming much more obvious and smoother. And we had bits of that with Apple TV and Chrome, and it's very obvious. What you were saying about the car stuff, where it's like, okay, the car just becomes a screen for your phone. So there is this sense that you may be carrying this thing, but it can take advantage of the screens that are around you or the other places that are there. And that's an obvious thing that people quite like, but you've got to be careful how you do. You don't actually want, as you say, your intimate messages appearing on the television screen in front of everyone else in the room. So you want to have some control over which one you're using for what.
I would say the analog is music. Think how we've changed how we consume music. We used to listen in groups at concerts, or then we would have our stereo. And it's got more and more intimate. The phone is very much like the iPod, where the music now is a very personal connection, one-on-one, despite the Microsoft Squirt ads where people were sharing their head earbuds. I think really people pretty much, their music, they consume solo, in a solitary way. And I think computing is rapidly moving that direction.
I think that's back and forth. I think it was a solitary thing, but the ability to cast it to the room is useful too. They sell a lot of these large Bluetooth speakers as well as selling a lot of headphones.
I guess they do, yeah. That's mostly because I can't hold my phone, my precious. I have to put it down while I wash the dishes.
I mean, I think there's no question we'll be flicking, you know, different types of media and projecting things and using all the screens around it. It's just like, frankly, I don't think it's a very interesting business to be a screen manufacturer. And so it's just the question is, like, where is the nexus of software and information and communication? And, you know, I'm sure there'll be things that look the size of tablets or bigger tablets that I'll be, you know, pushing data to. But I don't think the companies – I think it's an interesting decision for a company to focus on those right now.
Yeah.
Sam, is that a replicator? What is that behind you?
That's a MakerBot.
MakerBot.
Yeah.
Nice.
Second generation.
What have you been building lately?
You know, it's funny. I was one of the early investors in MakerBot, and huge believer in what they're doing. The coolest things we ever used to print is I actually used to have it in a conference room at Facebook, and the teams would print out three-dimensional DAU and MAU reports on it. So we'd have a meeting. And we'd have
you'd have little graphs, little 3D graphs.
No, it wouldn't be 3D. It'd be a picture of the. It would be a globe of the world.
Yeah.
And then we'd basically do the heights of different populations.
Wow.
So you could see a map of the world.
Man, whatever happened to those? Are they like on a shelf somewhere?
I think so. I think a bunch of them got chucked, but they were pretty cool.
That is awesome data visualization. That's the best use for a 3D printer I've heard in a long time.
It's a great way. You know, if you're blind, you can figure out how we're doing globally.
Yeah. Wow. That is very cool. Hey, congratulations to Jerry Ellsworth and her team at Cast AR. Remember, Jerry left Valve and convinced Gabe Newell to give her this. These are augmented reality glasses that project a game space in front of you. You're still looking through the glasses. You still see the world around you and your opponent, but you also seen the game space. It was a $1 million Kickstarter project a year ago. It has just shipped. The Cast AR has shipped their first pair of augmented reality glasses. Congratulations to Jerry and Rick and the team at Cast AR. They showed us an early prototype. It was put together.
What games does it run?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Its big focus is interactive gameplay, multiplayer gameplay.
Yeah, you can play chess with each other and like see the chessboard.
Right. Part of it is like taking tabletop gaming to the next step. So each person has their own perspective and a 3D view of a virtual tabletop, for example. But you can also play like a flight simulator, for example. It'll project on the wall if you hang up the right material. So you can have a 3D flight simulator where you can kind of look around, or you know, a driving game, that kind of thing too. So it's definitely a very different sort of technology than VR, but it's got a lot of potential. We're gonna have Jerry. We're having our next big thing panel at CES this year, and Jerry's gonna be on there talking.
She
about
is the greatest.
AR,
I am.
So I'm pretty excited about it.
I am mad for Jerry. She's so brilliant and wonderful and cool, and she. This video is showing her actually shipping the first Cast AR. That tube is the playing surface, so it casts onto a playing surface. That's the coordinate. So it's really, for tabletop gaming, it's awesome.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Yeah.
It, it's like a retroreflective surface, effectively. So whatever your cast air glasses project, they get reflected back to you, but not to anybody else. So that's how it gives you a personalized display. And everybody else has their own display. Ultimately, you're seeing the same world, but from different perspectives. Yeah.
Very exciting. Thank you. I'm glad you knew all about it, because I played with it, but I wasn't sure
what. Cool stuff. It's very cool stuff.
It's really cool. And congratulations to Circuit Girl. Hey, I want to thank you all for being here. I just have one question for you, Sam. What do you have against Carthage?
It needs to burn.
That is I don't know why you have that on a poster, but that is that anybody who studied the Romans or Latin. We did it in Latin.
Yeah.
Was it Cato?
I didn't get that far.
I can't remember. He said Carthage must be destroyed.
Carthage must burn.
Carthage must burn. And then that is it has been. It's done. It's over. We salted it. You don't have to worry about Carthage anymore. Move on with your life. Carthage must be destroyed. Carthago delenda est.
That's the poster.
Is there an explanation for it?
It's a long story, but
you're just a fan of the Third Punic War. I understand. Who isn't?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Those.
Exactly. It was a limited edition Punic War. It's one of the few surviving.
So is Carthage MySpace here? Is that what this is about?
Aha! Mm. Oh, I think there's a conspiracy theory here going on.
You guys can come up with all the conspiracy theories.
Did Mark hand those out at a special all hands meeting? Come on, come on.
You guys, all the conspiracy theories you want. I just listen. I was a good Latin student. My name in Latin class was Ignifer.
Ignifer, what does that mean? Bearer of dumbness.
Fire. Anyway.
So they told you, anyway.
Okay, complete this phrase. Qui, qui, quad.
No, I can't say it. That's good.
Very good. He remembers his conjugations. Sam, it's great to talk to you once again. Please come back. We'd love to have you on a regular basis.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
It's so much fun to have you. And you're in the Bay Area, right? Come up and visit us sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to sometimes. Couldn't make it work today, but sometime that'd be great.
Anytime. We'll be in touch. I'd love to do it again. Yeah. And my regards to Jessica, and everybody should subscribe to the information. We have our subscription. It's $400 a year, right?
Yep. You can read my article tomorrow. Got one coming out.
I see one here. I wonder if they published the Uber as gatekeeper to the physical world. That's you got another one coming.
That was, I think, last week's.
Ah.
I got my weekly thing on Monday.
This was from the Uber Spotify announcement, which was immediately eclipsed by the Uber we're going to get you announcement.
Too bad, because it's an interesting announcement directionally of where the world's going.
I thought it was great. You get in the. I mean, I'm not a Spotify customer or an Uber customer, but in theory, if you were, you'd get in the car and your tunes would be playing.
All I want in the future is to be able to walk into a bar and have them change the music. Know who I am and make my favorite drink on demand. And I think Uber might get us there over time.
Hello, Sam. Would you like another Pisco Sour? We have
absolutely.
Yes. we have put Garth Brooks on the jukebox. Please enjoy.
Enjoy. I intend to get it.
I like it. You're right. This is where Uber's headed. Ignore all this stuff.
Your car, they know you're 2 minutes away from the restaurant. Prepare the table. Check me in.
Love it.
Yeah, you know, that's going to be awesome.
Let's give up this whole privacy notion. We want that.
You can control it, but in the end of the day, and you should control it. But at the end of the day, why would you not want that?
Why wouldn't you want that?
Everyone wants that. Privacy.
Yeah. I want, as I walk by the pants store, I want them to throw pants at me, say, well, you need some new pants. Here they are. We've already made them to your size.
And by the way, you can rent them. Just return them later.
That's right. Just throw them in the autonomous vehicle when you're done and we'll drive it back to us.
Absolutely.
Tim Stevens, he does car tech at CNET at cnet.com/topics/car-tech. You can follow him on the Twitter at Tim_Stevens. Always great to have you on.
Thank you.
How many feet of snow do you have today?
It actually was up over melting, so we have no snow left at this point. It's going to be 60 degrees. It was down to like 17 degrees a couple days ago, and it's going to be 60 again on Monday. So weird weather pattern.
You're near Buffalo, but you're not near enough to get the lake effect.
No, we're a long way from Buffalo. Actually, we're out to the east part of the state. So we missed all the lake effect fun that all those folks out west got to play.
That was wild.
Insane. Yeah, insane amounts of snow.
Have you ever had that kind of, I mean, 6 feet of snow. Have you ever had that kind of snow?
Yeah, pretty close to it. I grew up in Vermont, so we had some pretty big snowstorms when I was a kid. I remember just digging tunnels with my sister and making, you know, we had a hill we'd go sliding on, and we'd just build a tunnel and go sliding down through the tunnel instead of on
right.
top of the snow.
That's how you get out of your house.
Yep.
You saw the picture. The guy opens the door. I wonder if that's on here. The guy opens the door, and instead of the outside world, there's a big snow wall with mm-hmm. his door imprinted in it.
And he put his beers in there.
And like he, yeah, that was a good one. He put his beers in it. It made a nice fridge. Oh, man. So you don't get snow like that where you are?
Not up in Albany these days, no. We don't get quite that much. But, yeah, out west, out toward the lake, definitely you can get a lot of snow real quick.
Well, I'll be watching the did you watch the Jets game? Was it snowing in Buffalo? I missed it.
I did not. No, I'm not a football fan, I confess.
That's why we have you on. On Sundays. No one on this show could be a football fan. Otherwise, we would never get anybody on this show. Kevin Marks, you're probably a football fan in that English way.
Not really, no. No,
no, of course not. It's always good to talk to you. Kevin tweeted and said, I want to talk about net neutrality. I said, Kevin, you can be on this show anytime you want.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I may take it up that again.
It's great.
I may just get some more lighting out here.
I like how it's slowly getting darker. That's good. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC on twit.tv. We love it if you watch live because I watch the chat room and snicker. But if you can't, don't worry. On-demand audio and video is always available after the fact. Twit.tv. You can also get it on you know, all your podcast clients and all that stuff. It's on YouTube, too, youtube.com/thisweekintech. If you want to share it with your friends, you can do it from there. And if you want to be in our studio, our live studio audience, it's kind of fun today. We had we started with 20 people. There's six left. What happened? Did we chased you all away? If you want to be here, you don't have to stay the whole time. Nobody does, really. If you do, bring snacks and maybe a catheter. Just email tickets at twit.tv and you can be in the audience. And pay a special attention. New Year's Eve is coming up and we are going to have a New Year's Eve benefit marathon for UNICEF. We're raising money for UNICEF. We are going to go from 3 a.m. New Year's Eve to 3 a.m. New Year's Day, and we will say Happy New Year to every time zone around the world in that time via Skype calls. We'll have a balloon drop. We'll have champagne. It'll be a lot of fun. We've got bands. We've got fun. You can be here if you email tickets at twit.tv. Tickets will be limited because a lot of people want to come to that. Most of our hosts will be here. It's going to be a lot of fun. The week before, we do our best of, and I encourage you to submit any ideas you have for our best of, twit.tv/best of, for any of the shows. We put best ofs together, and it'll be during Christmas week this week, this year, rather. If you know the episode number, that'd be great. I hope you know the show name, but if you don't, just write in the comments, there was this thing that happened with the thing, and it would be really good to have that in a best of. It'll help our producers. Jason Howell, our hardworking producers and editors, put something together. By the way, if you want to be on our New Year's Eve show, there are some unfilled time zones. You got to figure we got the East Coast covered. We probably have Sydney covered. I know, Sam, we're going to cover British Standard Time for us, right? But I imagine there will be people. If you're in the Solomon Islands, if you're in Uzbekistan, if you're in Tuvalu, go to twit.tv/NYE. Anywhere like that. If you're in a faraway land, let us know what time zone you're in so we can have, you know, Skype over to you and you can have a little party for us. There's all the time zones. There are 27, right? Something like that. Because some of these balloon drops will be at quarter after and half past. They're all over there. It's so weird. Anyway, we'll be doing that. Also, we still have a few shirts left. If you would like to get a holiday gift for the geek in your life, we've got Twit dress shirts and Twit polo shirts at Teespring, TWEspring.com/Twit. We tried to come up with something people would like for the holidays. So we have embroidered polo shirts for men and women and embroidered dress shirts for men and women. Maybe that wasn't the best thing to choose. We've only sold 200 of them. But You only have 7 days left, so get on over there. I know everybody's waiting. They're gonna. You don't have to snipe this. The price doesn't change. It's going to be the same price in 7 days. But after 7 days, it's gone. TEEteespring.com/twit. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next week. Another twit.
This is amazing. Bye.